galaxy, the Knights of the Soul Star Order, defenders of justice and truth, have been ambushed by the evil magicians, the Direites.
This is the world of the Micronauts, a Croyer, the enemy, and the Micronaut Space Warriors, all sold separately.
Discover Planet of the Apes.
The Shogun Warriors, Guy King with rocket boosters, Great Mazinga with rocket launcher.
Look, it's Godzilla!
Is he friend or foe? You can decide.
Wow.
Launch his claw. Imagine his breath is a blast of fire.
House of License Ideas, Episode 3. This is Herman coming at you from the Far East. And I'm joined by my co-host, the Bronze Age Master of Weird, Mr. Billy D. How's it going, Billy?
It's doing pretty good. You know, we Western scum are doing pretty good over here.
Oh, yeah.
Just teasing, folks. Yeah, everything's good over here, you know. There's some nice weather. It's pretty calm.
Yeah,
my daughter just had a birthday. That was pretty cool too. So yeah, it's been great lately.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm looking at the media, everything's going well except in Florida.
Well, yeah, it's I don't know what's going to happen here. It was, fingers crossed, man, that things get figured out, because it's, you don't need another rerun of 2020. That's what we don't need.
Yeah, definitely. And if you look at the Marvel Universe that we're going to be discussing today, things aren't going so hot in West Virginia and, you know, over in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And if you want to think about a Daytona Beach as well, which is in Florida, right, Billy, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep. Mm-hmm, it sure is. Yeah, I mean, it's the next thing you know, there'll be a bunch of wraiths running around here from these variants and strains and crap.
That's right. Wraiths, kaijus, and... probably, if you think about it, little miniature, you know, shock troops from Spartak in the Microverse. They're just tearing up the whole country. So mm-hmm. It's going to be a lot of fun. Now, mm-hmm. Of course, House of Licensed Ideas, we focus on Marvel's licensed properties. Specifically, this time around, we're still doing ROM, which is our favorite, I believe, then Godzilla. Mm-hmm. And then we're still... looking at Micronauts. Now we might change this up, you know, come episode 5, where we look at something different briefly, but we'll always get back to mm-hmm. to our favorites. And I'm hoping that mm-hmm. you know, once we get some feedback, once we put some polls out there on Patreon, we'll also get some an idea of what the listeners, our Patreon subscribers, would like to see on the House of Licensed Ideas, and we'll definitely cover that. But for now, ROM's up first. So, Billy, let's quickly talk about the cover first, and then I'll give a brief rundown on, you know, the previous few issues and where we are at the moment. So, first off, before we give our synopses, what did you think about this cover to ROM number 3?
I like it. I don't love it. I don't know what it is. Like, I like yellow and orange, but the green, like all the heroes, or I'm sorry, not the heroes, all the humanoid looking people are all in green, and I don't know, they're just, it looks kind of funky. I almost wish maybe they were different colors or something, because the green's kind of throwing me off there. I don't know if they look Hulkish to me or something, but it looks kind of wonky to me. But otherwise, I do really like it. It's ROM, you know, blasting away at some wraiths here, so yeah. I always enjoy that.
I know what you mean. The cover is okay. It's not spectacular. But I do like the fact that one of the attackers assaulting ROM in the foreground is shredded by the blast from his neutralizer. Of course, we know that doesn't really happen. It could if he wishes it. But, you know, normally he just banishes them. But that guy is being banished to limbo, as we see on the cover there. It's not bad, you know, but yeah, maybe the colors, like you say, don't work for me. For me, it's more the yellow mm-hmm. in the background, but also, you know, this green glow. I mean, like you say, if you're a Marvel fan, it makes you think of the Hulk gamma radiation. And there's nothing gamma yeah. about this issue at all.
No, not at all.
Much later, of course, Ron will encounter the Green Goliath, and others in the Marvel Universe. But this is early days, right, Billy? So we're seeing Rom not yet interacting with the rest of the Marvel Universe. But, you know, I like the way Rom's drawn and the pose that he's in. You know, he's grabbing one guy, you know, above his head and blasting away at the other, I think, other three, you know, surrounding him with these futuristic weapons. I mean, the weapon that the guy that's being shredded sports, that is some serious sci-fi tech.
Yeah.
And then I've always loved the effect of them plunging into limbo, as I've mentioned before. So that that part of the cover definitely works. But like you say, I think this is when Frank Miller still was, he was already a great artist at this point in time, but he wasn't yet a good cover artist. In fact, I don't know if he ever did become a good, I mean, obviously he did later on. I mean, Dark Knight Returns had some great covers, Sin City. So it's just these early days. I never, I can't remember any, there are some iconic Frank Miller covers. I just can't remember them, you know? So yeah, this was when he was still getting the feel for covers, I think. But
yeah,
but not a bad cover and a fantastic issue, I'm sure you'd agree. But before we get to that, Billy, I'm going to give some details and then we get into our Twitter synopsis, our Twitter style, 280 character synopsis. All right. This is, of course, like we've mentioned, ROM issue 3, publisher Marvel, and a cover dated February 1980, but on sale November the 6th, 1979. Cover price 40 cents, page count 32, edited by Mary Jo Duffy. And as we mentioned, cover by Frank Miller, but inked by Terry Austin. So fantastic inker, Terry.
Oh, yeah.
And the title of the story, Firefall. Mm-hmm. And then we have the writer, of course, Bill Mantlo, artist Sal Buscema, lettered by Tom Orkowski, and colored by Ben Sean, who's a colorist I'm not really familiar with. Ben Sean.
Yeah, that's a name you see in the late, you know, Bronze Age and Copper Age with Marvel, but not a lot. You know, you see more of Glynis Wien and oh gosh, who's the other prominent colorist? I can't think of, it's another lady, and I can't think of what her name is off the top of my head now. But yeah, you don't see a lot. I mean, there is. I'm sure this guy's a good bit of credits, but it's not one of the names you see on the regular.
Right, right, right. I mean, Glynis Wien, like you mentioned, was the colorist on the previous episode, on the previous comic on the issue. But I don't know. The colors don't really bother me too much in this issue at all. I mean, you've got Sal Buscema's art coming through very strongly and the color sort of enhancing that. So, you know, good on Ben Sean for delivering adequate. I wouldn't say it's amazing. You know, but, you know, then I am reading it in its original form. So, you know, the colors have faded over time. I like the effect. So interesting, right, Billy? Now, on to the synopsis. I'm going to let you go first. This was a doozy.
Okay. Oh, yeah, this one's crazy. And the crazier, the better with Rom.
That's right.
All right. So from the previous issue, we see the sinister Archie Stryker. And he is at Project Safeguard with the military, and they make him an offer he can't refuse. Meanwhile, Rom Rom recounts his origin, then Brandy gets hauled in by the police, and they ask her questions about her relationship with Rom.
Oh, you don't want to be doing that, especially not with a little spitfire like Brandy. Excellent summary, Mr. B. I thought I'd change it up a little bit and go the poetic route. So I inserted a bit of rhyme. Just call this a Rom rhyme. Rhyming Rom. And it goes as follows. While Rom evaporates, dire wraith scum, Archie Stryker's mind comes undone. He volunteers as a think tank's pawn, running an obstacle course from dusk till dawn. Then, Rom tracks down a nefarious portal, while Brandy lusts after our cybernetic mortal. But blasphemy occurs at the very end. Stryker's in the body of Rom's dead friend. the end.
Good one.
A bit of rhyme there, yeah, man. Don't worry, listeners. I'm not going to be doing it with every single synopsis. That's going to get old pretty fast. But a fantastic issue. So, Billy, let's get into this. All right. First off, we've got, you know, the opening page here.
I want to
ask
it.
You, this is great. I love it when a story opens with some, you know, sinister group or, you know, organization looking at a video of their antagonist and discussing how to take him down.
Yeah, I don't know where I've seen this before, but I know I have seen this before, and I love it where it's, you know, like you said, a group in a darkened room, and they have a projector going, and they're watching, you know, film of whoever they're trying to take out, and this is a great scene. You have somebody watching this film of Rom destroying some raids, and the guy, it's horrible, horrible.
Exactly. Yeah, no, it does look horrible. I mean, it looks almost as if some of the footage has been edited, because there's a guy being immolated in the foreground, a soldier of the U.S. Army by Rom. And, you know, that didn't really happen. I mean, unless he was a wraith. And we know that the effect of Rom's neutralizer is sometimes deceptive, right? Because it could seem as if he is, in fact, you know, scorching folks. But, in fact, he's banishing them to limbo, just destroying their physical forms. Or not really their physical forms. Sort of like there's some residue left after the neutralizer has banished them. You know, it might be that they're shedding some extra molecules or something based off of their shape changing. It's never quite clear, but he's definitely not, you know, blasting them to pieces like he is in this video. So you don't know, it might have been doctored, because who's in the crowd, Billy? Who's in this, who's watching this video along with the Wraith think tank, who we all know is disguised as government, you know, agents and government folks.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the crazy Archie Stryker, and he's like the next page you turn, the top panel, and he's sitting there grimacing like he's constipated or just ready to lose his mind, watching Rom grinning his teeth and like.
Oh, that's great.
That's a great Sal Buscema face right there.
That's what I was going to say next. That's one of the best, you know, and you see that crop up again and again, but I never tire of it. I never tire of that Sal Buscema face. It's a shock and awe and indignation all put together just with a few strokes of a pen or a pencil at first. And then, you know, so amazing. And, you know, we've obviously still got this whole, you know, idea of the Wraiths looking for a weapon to use against Rom. And they're just going to, you know, use Archie Stryker's hatred, because Stryker seems to be kind of like, let's say, Ben Affleck's Batman in, you know, Batman versus Superman. He's got this hate on for aliens. And you know what I mean, right, Billy?
Oh, yeah.
And he has been severely traumatized psychologically when he saw Rom in action and how callously he takes lives, which, he, in fact, he didn't do. You know, like we mentioned, he just took down some wraiths. So now Archie Stryker's suddenly become the champion of humanity, at least in his own mind.
Yeah, I don't know if maybe Matt Lowe was trying to, like, work in some subtle, like, bigotry angle with him, you know? That could be it, but, I mean, it is kind of crazy, you know, I think, you know, a robot just shows up and starts blasting people that look human. You're going to think this guy's, like, terrorizing, those robots terrorizing the planet, so. But Archie, yeah, he really goes off the deep end here.
Now, we've got the cast of Wraiths showing up again. I'd say these are the sort of the bureaucratic Wraiths. They're not really the leaders. They're more in positions of earthly power, you know. But the real leaders, of course, are working even further behind the scenes. So these are the more the public face of the Wraith menace. And it's Dr. Daedalus. This is his first appearance, by the way. You know, Dr. Daedalus, one of the Wraiths. And we've got so Dr. Daedalus will be in charge of, you know, dealing with coming up with a weapon to use against Rom, because earthly weapons, clearly, right, Billy, are ineffectual.
Yeah, they don't hurt Rom at all, really.
That's right. And then we've got Rachel Sweet She's always a good, wraith villain to have around, because she's always disguised as this Betsy DeVos looking, not really completely Betsy DeVos, but you know, she wears this little business like outfit with this her hair tied in the back and then his glasses. And Sal Buscema draws great women too. I don't mean that he always draws attractive women. I mean the way they look, it's completely different from the men, which is as it should be. I don't know what I'm trying to say here, but you can easily recognize it.
Yeah, Sal's good at drawing people. There's not, when he draws like a wraith, you do see that they look a little sinister, you know, so it's not, he doesn't, you know, there's some of the guesswork is taken out of it there for you a little bit, I guess. But yeah, the way he draws her, she almost reminds me of on the Wonder Woman television show when she would be like, you know, working her civilian job and she'd pull her hair back like that.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. She, oh, that's
kind of looks
call.
Like that a little bit.
She does look definitely like the Wonder Woman from the 70s. Yeah, when she's in disguise as her alter ego. Oh, yeah, that's a good call. I was fishing for an image that I couldn't get, you know. So well done there, really. Yeah, I mean, Rachel Sweets there. Then Kevin Crawler, who's this Clay Quatermain lookalike. You know, he's associated with S.H.I.E.L.D., but he always wears...
S.H.I.E.L.D.,
His like Clay Quatermain did, he always wears this... what do you call it? This holster, you know, this gun holster.
Yeah, like a blue. Fury used to dress in Fury. Charge.
Exactly. Yeah. So they're the resident wraith, public menace, the face of the wraiths, but you know, all disguised as human. And then, of course, later on, Brandi Clark shows up again, plus her boyfriend Steve Jackson. And then we've got, you know, a new, a location showing up, which is Project Safeguard. And we'll find more, find out about that more as we go through the issue. So, Billy, then we get into we already see the gist of their plan, because in the previous two issues, Rom completely devastated any, military, might that they threw against him. With their influence, and now they're finally starting to realize, okay, we've got to get a better weapon and bring that to bear. And, Rom, meanwhile, he's been keeping busy, right, Billy? What's he been doing?
Yeah, it's funny. You see him, and he's trying to basically, like, he's doing a lot of thinking. There's a lot of caption. He like, inner monologues a lot. And then he goes through the whole, you know, like I said, he's thinking about his origin and coming to Earth, meeting Brandi, and, you know, when he volunteered to become, you know, one of the Space Knights and all that kind of stuff. And then he's like, snaps out of that, and he's kind of like starts getting pissed off, and he's like, I got to go find me some wraiths. And he pulls out his weapon there. Here we go. He starts flying off to find some trouble.
That's right. Now, Billy, this is interesting. You could look at it from a different perspective. You could say that, you know, while he's standing there on the hill, you know, overlooking the countryside, and like you say, he's musing, he's lost in thought. His thoughts are first of Brandi, right? Of him saving her, and how she at first feared him and then came to trust him. And then immediately it goes to his lost humanity. So he's definitely, there's definitely something about Brandi that causes him to wish that he was still human, so that he probably wants to hook up with her, you know, because there's a connection between them, you know. It's not just from Brandi's side, although Brandi's really the one pushing for it, you know. She's she really doesn't like old Steve Jackson. She just wants to get away from him.
But Steve must be kind of a knucklehead if a robot can swoop in a day and take his woman away.
Yeah, no, that's true. Maybe he's just not satisfying Brandi. Maybe Brandy's hoping that there's another instrument hidden in subspace other than the neutralizer. No, I'm back. No, I take that back. Sorry, listeners. But, you know, there's a horrific scene, right, Billy, where you see them taking the scalpel to Rom as he's lying on the operating table. This is after they've already grafted on the living armor to his chest. And then, of course, his hands are now those classic mitten hands. And that's probably, that was my biggest, the thing that really turned me off about the new Rom series from what is it, IDW, right? I picked up the first issue way back. What is it now? Already 6-7 years gone. And he didn't have his mitten hands. I mean, what the hell? Jeez.
Ooh.
Yeah. So after that, and even I think when the series had a brief resurgence in the 80s, there was a time when he didn't have those cool looking, you know, metallic cyborg Santa mittens, like a Santa from space, except not bringing presents, but bringing some hurting for the diarrheas. But he scans this countryside. Now we see how powerful this analyzer of his is, right, Billy? He can scan an entire, what, in
a town.
It's an entire town. I'd say that's at least a 60-mile or more radius, probably even more, who knows, because he's far off, you know, way beyond the town, in the mountains, in the hills. He sees some diarrhea activity that the analyzer detects, and then he takes off. Then we've got this scene with Brandy that you mentioned, and she's thinking Rom. It's just Rom all the time, Rom, Rom, Rom. But she shows up at her apartment, and these two, what appears to be G-men, of course, we'll find out that that's not the case, but they show up. Her apartment, though, has been totaled completely, overturned. Oh, yeah. So, you know, it could be them. It is them, but they pretend that it's not, and they say, "Come with us. We're the government." And then, Billy, I want you to speak about the next scene. Now, this is the craziest bit. Archie Stryker, you know, he used to be a Korean vet, right? He fought in the Korean War, but you know, this is a long time after the Korean War. This is, you know, late 70s, early 80s, right?
20 years at least. Yeah,
20 years, and yet, what happens?
Oh, yeah. He's like this ultimate killing machine now, and he's going through this, like, obstacle course with, like, you know, machine guns popping out of bushes and trying to kill him, and, you know, edged weapons being thrown at him and jumping over booby traps and stuff like that. And I love when the automatic weapon pops out of a tree to try to shoot him, and he shoots it with a laser pistol and says, "Stinking automatic sniper."
Oh, so this like what you say shows his character. He's bigoted, but towards machines and machinery, like Rom, and like automatic snipers. No, he doesn't go for that. But the guy still got, you know, some mad skills, right? I believe we could see that he probably was this Korean, is this perfect soldier during the Korean War, because he showcases some fantastic reflexes. He blasts all these things out of the trees and scales this massive wall. And then right as he, you know, scales this wall, these rockets, I mean, mini rockets are launched right at his face. he manages to take them out. Sploosh, he's in the drink, but he survives. And then, you know, we've got Crawler and we've got Rachel Sweet standing around. So smiling, right? Smug that he's soaked. And then what?
Covered in mud.
Yeah, covered in mud. What does he say, Billy?
He just looks right at them and goes, "Glad you're amused, you stinking." And they just cut him off. I'm like, let's go, pal.
Okay, so they put him through his paces, but I don't even know why, because this is going to render whatever he could do physically completely obsolete, right, Billy? Because they take them into the lab of Dr. Daedalus. And he reveals to Archie and to his cohorts their secret weapon, which is the corpse. Well, I mean, since the armor is living armor, right, that the Space Knights wear, right, Billy? This is technically the corpse of one of Rom's old Space Knight compatriots, Space Knight by the name of Firefall. And it appears as if all the Space Knights had their own, you know, distinctive weaponry. In Rom's case, you had the neutralizer, and in Firefall's, you know, case, you had this living fire, the living fire of Galador that he wields. Much like Pyro from the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, he can control this fire, this living fire, to do whatever he wants. And it's also, you know, the temperature is way higher than just normal flame, so it could actually hurt someone like Rom, who can survive the heat of suns. Flying through space. So this is a real danger for Rom. And we'll see in the next issue, in fact, it is suitably, you know, it's the only thing that's hurt him so far.
Right.
All right, yeah. So Firefall's armor is here, and they say that, you know, Stryker, you need some, you need an ace in the hole here. You need something extra to take down Rom, and this is it. So he's at first reluctant, right, Billy, because this is the antithesis of, this is what he hates. This is what he does not wish to become, you know,
yeah.
But he's going to have to, and they sort of convince mm-hmm. him of that, but not too much resistance on his part. But Billy, what is this Wraith activity that Rom detected in the hills?
Well, it's funny. He goes like flying into this like cave, and he goes, "There is evil here, dire evil, Wraith evil." And he's creeping through this cave, and then all of a sudden you see like a giant like research subterranean cavern. It seems like a research facility, and there's like a humongous satellite dish. What the hell that's going to do underground? I don't know.
Yeah,
but. they're building all sorts of equipment, and there's men everywhere and like experiments, and then he gets the old analyzer out and points at this one guy. He can see, you know, there's Wraiths here, so he just starts going bananas and blasting the crap out of them. It's great.
Yeah. Now this is now what the Wraiths are known for, right, Billy? They're very effective at infiltrating a world's ruling caste or class or systems, and then they marry the technology of whatever world they're on with their own tech, and then they create something mm-hmm. completely new. That probably explains the satellite dish, but like you say, this is not gonna, you know, act like a normal dish. This is just to conceal it, you know, and I don't know why they shaped it as a dish, but you know, it is basically there to open a portal, like you say, to the interdimensional limbo, to which Rom and presumably other space knights banish the Wraiths, because they want to free their brethren trapped in this phantom zone like, you know, place. Mm-hmm. And Rom yeah. will definitely not allow that. Now, earlier I mentioned that, you know, we will see a little bit of Project Safeguard. We already did, you know, that's where Archie Stryker has been trained, where they've got Firefall stashed. And Project Safeguard is basically like Wraith HQ. Whereas this is just one of their many, many hidden labs, you know, scattered around the country. Project Safeguard is a Pentagon-esque, you know, building. But this obviously is just, it's nothing to do with that. It's just like one of their hidden bases, like I mentioned. But I forgot to talk about that when Rachel Sweet and them were showing him Firefall. It's an American military intelligence center in Washington, D.C., right, Billy? And it was led by one of the Wraith leaders called the Most High One. We'll see him crop up later. And the Most High One. What is he smoking? A lot of Earth hashish there? Or
yeah.
Why are they calling him that? He's particularly
hanging out with Starlin.
Yeah, Starlin. And they're going for late night movie matinees and smoking up the whole theater. I mean, Wraith could, the Most High One could be Jim Starlin for all we know. I mean, shape changing, right, Billy?
Maybe Englehart. Yeah, I don't know.
Definitely. And then, you know, of course, they combined human and, like I say, Wraith technology there. And then they normally gave it to humans, you know, to, you know, either as a means of taking out their enemies or of combating space knights. And, yeah, we even saw Rachel Sweet flying towards that in the previous issue when she was in the form of a raven. Do you remember that, Billy? And then...
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just want to mention that the Wraiths have these headquarters scattered out throughout the country, but the main one is definitely Project Safeguard. And we'll see more of that. They've been on Earth quite a while. They've been busy.
Right. Yeah, that's the deal here. You know, you get to find out pretty quick here that, you know, Rom just got to Earth, but the Wraiths have been here for quite a while doing their shenanigans behind the scene to try to take over.
Yeah, that's right. Now, it seems that he arrives just in time too, right, Billy? Because this machine, this interdimensional transporter, is almost ready. So Rom just goes berserk, and he left and right just he analyzes these people, and the ones who aren't Wraiths he won't touch, but the Wraiths he'll definitely banish to limbo with horrific effect from his neutralizer, which looks great. It really looks like he's blasting these folks to shreds. And yeah. I love it. And then also, you know, they showcase Rom's strength. I mean, Billy, speak on some of the feats that you see just in these few short action, you know, well, it's actually a couple of pages of action, but
yeah,
it's a couple of panels of action. And Rom showcases his massive, his titanic power on the level of, let's say, slightly below someone like Thor or the Hulk.
Mm-hmm. You have some crazy wraith that gets into a like forklift type vehicle, almost like a small like Jeep or something, and tries to ram it into Rom. And he just stands there and doesn't even budge and just puts his hand out and the vehicle smashes and like kind of crumples up. And the guy goes flying out of it because, of course, he's not wearing a seatbelt because nobody gave a crap about seatbelts in 1979. And
yeah, good point. Rom
picks up the vehicle and the guy goes flying and he goes, and a fitting epitaph for the one bound for limbo. And the guy's like, ah! He blasts the crap out of him. And he goes flying into the little portal into limbo there. And then Rom, instead of just setting the car down, takes it and throws it, smashes it right into that crazy satellite dish I said about earlier.
Yeah, and that causes like a power surge. Yeah, Billy, you're right, man. Rom is power. I mean, that vehicle that he was rammed with, that's like a heavy equipment mover. That's the only thing I can think that it might be used for. And he accordions it just by reaching out his hand. It must have been traveling at least 40 miles an hour and hit him. And then it doesn't even faze him. And Rom's pretty good at picking up vehicles, throwing them into the air, and then blasting the folks inside them and sending them to limbo. He did that with a cop, the sheriff, in fact.
In the last one.
Yeah. Oh, that was great. And then, you know, a fantastic panel of this wraith being banished to limbo as he plunges through dimensions and there's this no sound effect. It's just great. But this power surge, Billy, it's got far-reaching effects. I mean, the nearby town, which is in West Virginia, it's basically throughout West Virginia, which is a city, right? But they, you know, this nearby town where things are going to go down, that's this the first place to feel the brunt of this power surge, because it seems like everybody's, you know, gadgets, phones, appliances, it's all going nuts. And then, that's no exception in the house of Brandy Clark's folks, because their TV, their telephone is looking like it's been struck by, you know, lightning. It is being, it looks like it really. And Steve Jackson arrives there looking for Brandy, and then he finds out that she never came home. She said she's going to go to her apartment. And then Steve, we see he's a bit of a dick, because he's one of those controlling boyfriends that says, I told her not to go there. She didn't listen to me, damn it. So he's very upset and he runs, but his car works, right, Billy? But his ignition goes haywire. So I don't know how he got the car to work, but he takes off in the direction of Brandy's apartment and finds it completely empty and ransacked. So he doesn't know what's happened to her.
Steve's a piece of crap. This is what he says as he's running out of the house to go find Brandy. And it's like, okay, I'd be worried. I'd be like, oh no, what's happening? I hope she's okay. Nope. Here's Steve's dialogue. That headstrong little idiot. Mm. I told her to stay here. What?
Yeah.
What a jackass.
Yeah, man.
He's awful. Oh,
dude, he's a piece of work, I'm telling you, Steve.
Yeah.
Jerk. Yeah, not one of my favorite supporting characters. But, so, you know, Rom, cut back to Rom, right? He's still blasting away at wraiths here, banishing them to limbo with a yee. Or yee? I don't know how to say that. Anyway. Yeah, that's probably better. And then, oh man, Billy, that's awesome. We've got the Firefall. Now Archie Stryker in the body of Firefall committing the ultimate affront to Rom, because Dire Wraith technology has now allowed someone else to walk around in the dead body of Rom's friend. And Rom's like blasting away. He's got a girder in his hand. I don't know why he's got that girder, but he's like crushing it like a piece of paper. And and then Archie Stryker, he can't wait. He just jumps the gun and he blasts Rom with the living fire. Now, Rom does not yet know quite what's going on. All he knows is he's hurt. He feels the pain, but he manages to hurl this plasma-like flame from him, which has got some solid substance to it. And it returns to Archie, and then Rom beholds Firefall in all his former glory. because now he, at first, because he's disoriented from the pain that the fire caused, so he says, Karras, is that you? You know, meaning his old mate, his old Space Knight friend, And then the final panel, in fact, reveals, no, Billy, what does Archie say there? Very dramatic.
He says, yeah, the name's Archie Stryker Rom, but you can call me Firefall. And there's a great Sal Buscema pissed off face right there.
That's right. Now, this is interesting, Billy. Yeah, oh, that's a great Sal Buscema. But it's also a little bit of a pleasure in with mixed within the anger in there, right? With the fury. You can see he's looking forward to this Donnybrook that's going to happen. But, you know, this this begs the question, right, Billy? Now, Firefall, of course, is the name Archie gave himself. And I always thought that, you know, Firefall is just like the name that, you know, the Karras always had. But in fact, you know, Rom, Karras, they don't really have, you know, superhero-esque names, if you know what I mean. His name was just Karras. And Archie dubbed himself Firefall, you know, because, you know, much later in the run of Rom in the series, they keep referring back to this instance, you know, of Rom's friend. And they keep talking about Firefall. They never say Karras again. You know, it's like Archie, you know, erased the name of Karras. And then everybody just knows him by the name of Firefall, even if they're talking about the dead Space Knight. Now, Billy, that's a fantastic next issue blurb down there at the bottom. And of course, great Marvel alliteration there. Can you read that to us?
Yeah, it says, next, glimpses of Galador, sinister subterfuge on Earth, and the fire, the friend, and the foe.
And every you know, a noun over in that sentence is highlighted. Well, it's written in flame. This is great.
Yep. Yep. In and then living on the flame. Next page, too. You got a pin up there. Oh, man.
Marvel Masterwork pin up, Rom. Oh, that's a beautiful page. Beautiful page.
Yeah, great job by Al Milgram there, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Al, you know, being a huge Rom fan. And a fantastic penciler in his own right. And I love the way Al draws the background where the people are fleeing from this. I mean, it's definitely got this 50s sci-fi alien invader movie, you know, vibe.
Absolutely.
I mean, those people are just fleeing for their lives. And this is one old man in the back. Well, he's closer to Rom than the rest, but he's screaming in terror, right? Almost covering his mouth. Whoa, and then you've got some, what, asteroids streaking there across the sky. You know, you've got this alien sky in the background. It's amazing.
Yeah, so great pin-up.
Fantastic issue, right, Billy?
Yeah, oh, the best.
All right, so now, Billy, we'll save our, you know, favorites for last when we've done all three issues. But this is a strong contender, certainly. Next up, though, we've got our favorite kaiju. In fact, the only kaiju I really know. You know, which is, of course, I mean, I know the rest. I know Mothra, you know, I know King Ghidorah, but yeah, I mean, Godzilla is the star, you know, so he's always going to be my favorite kaiju. I mean, there aren't any other kaiju that I would consider my favorites even, that come even close. So back to Godzilla. But this time, Billy, Godzilla number 3 has got an interesting cover because it's the first time that someone, a cast of characters from the rest of the Marvel universe shows up. And who are they?
That would be the Champions from Los Angeles.
Yeah, that's right. Champions. Mm-hmm. We'll talk more on them later. But interesting cover, right, Billy? Interesting cover because this is obviously meant to draw readers in, you know, from superhero titles and saying, oh, the Champions are showing up. Oh, in Godzilla. Oh, we got to see how they shape up against the big G. But the cover's okay. You know, I like the way Hercules is drawn. But before we talk the cover, let me quickly get to the specs here, to the details about the issue itself, and then we can do our synopsis and then talk covers. All right, so Godzilla number 3. Cover dated October 1977, but on sale July 5th, 1977. Price, 30 cents. Page count, 32. Edited by Archie Goodwin and cover art by Herb Trimpe. This is story is titled A Tale of Two Saviors. And then writer Doug Munch, penciler Herb Trimpe, inked by Tony DeZuniga. Yeah, you can see the DeZuniga coming through strongly. Yeah, lettered by Denise Wall, I should say, and another letterer that filled in as well, Irv Watanabe, and then colored by Don Warfield. And of course, you're reading it in the Essential Godzilla trade paperback, right? I believe Essential Godzilla from Marvel.
Yep.
I'm still reading it in the original issues, but I'm going to run out of them pretty soon and have to, you know, look at my Essential Godzilla as well, which is in a horrible state. I mean, you know, the humidity here in Taiwan's so high, dude, that, you know, I have to invest in a dehumidifier for every room, and I have to put these little dehumidifier packs in my shelves all the time. It's horrible. But unfortunately, Godzilla, one of my essentials that suffered, you know, believe from mold and humidity. So, it's one of the traits that I hardly ever touch.
Well, let me tell you something. This just blew up for some reason as far as sales go. I don't know what the reason for was, because I'm sure it's been out of print for many, many years. But before we had talked about covering Godzilla on our House of Licensed Ideas, you know, Patreon, I was pretty close to selling this because there were people getting upwards of $60 for this trade.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow. That is, well, that's for a good copy. Yeah, mine would probably not even go for a dollar, but, you know, that's how bad it looks. But, you know, I think you're right. I mean, lots of these old essentials, not lots, but some, you know, the rare ones, they're, you know, quite pricey when you look at them online. Also, DC, over at DC, you know, you've got the Showcase Presents, and some of the rarest ones, like House of Mystery Volume 1 and 2, Unknown Soldier, those ones, they're also pretty pricey. You know, you can sell them for quite a bit.
I mean, like, I get it. They're not going to be able to reprint this because they're not going to pay to have, you know, the rights to do Godzilla ever again. So that probably helped drive the price up. And maybe it wasn't like a high print run either, but it just struck me as kind of odd that anybody even gave a crap about it. Because usually, I don't know now, but 10, 15, 20 years ago, you could find Godzilla issues in every, you know, dollar, $2 tops, like probably even 50 cent bin. On the planet.
That's
so why... I don't know. I don't know why it went crazy here.
That's right. That's how I picked up my issues. I found them on the cheap, and I found like the first 10 quite easily. You know, when I started trolling the comic stores in the 90s in South Africa, and also looking at, you know, flea markets and stuff like that, I found, and I was like surprised that it was so cheap, because it's the first issue. Now, it's not in great condition. I describe it as fine or a little bit less than fine, you know, my Godzilla comics. But, I was, because even then, you know, Billy Godzilla was a big deal, and you know that Marvel wasn't going to do Godzilla again. They didn't have the rights. So, yeah, but I'm glad I did pick it up, because it's fun times.
Yeah, I mean, although I got to be honest, you living in Asia, I don't know that I'd have Godzilla comics in my house, because if he knows you have them there, yeah, you might get, your building might get stepped on. So
yeah, true. I just think that this is Godzilla, you know, not recognizing himself as Godzilla, because, or he might be offended by that, the fact that he's so differently depicted, you know, in Western comics. But yeah, Billy, there's a funny little rights issue here in Asia. Like, for instance, if you look at Comixology or, you know, the folks over at IDW publishing Godzilla comics, sometimes they are not allowed to sell it in Asia because, you know, Japan has the rights over here. They're only allowed to sell it in North America. So when Comixology first became prominent, I could buy everything you guys could buy except the Godzilla comics.
Well, that's weird.
Yeah, that's weird. Now, I don't know if that still stands, but it's interesting, you know? Very interesting.
Yeah, wow. Very, very crazy.
Yeah, man, crazy, dude. But, you know, there's lots of weird stuff over here. There's also, like, the Netflix issue, but we'll talk about that another time. But there's things we can't see over here because they're not allowed to show them. It's not because of the content or anything. It's just because they don't have the rights in certain regions of the world to show this kind of content, or it should be distributed by someone other than Netflix, because they have the right to distribute it over here. Some weird kind of, you know,
craziness.
Yeah. Anyway, but comics too.
Makes no sense.
Yeah, it makes no sense to me. But, you know, not a lot of digital comic readers over here in Asia. I mean, obviously in Japan they do have them. They love reading manga. digitally, but in Taiwan, hardly ever. I never see anybody with a device reading a comic book. Kids, none of them. And I see a lot of kids, you know, commuting on the train or you know, on the bus and stuff like that. Nobody reads digital comics. When they do read a comic, it's a physical comic that they've got from one of these comic rental stores. You know, it's like a library. You can go and rent some, well, you have to pay, of course, but you can rent these comics. And they love manga. They're insane about manga, but they will never, well, some might, but I've never seen it where they read it on a device. So, but you know, us too, I don't see a lot of people read digital comics that I know.
I was gonna say, sounds like my kind of place.
Yeah, exactly, man. I'm also not a fan of the digital. Maybe it's because we're old, right, Billy? But my eyes, man, even, you know, it's probably because I'm using the computer all the time, you know, for my work and so forth. But I want to rest my eyes, and I find it very, you know, relaxing to look at print in, you know, physical printed media rather than looking at screen. But you know, Godzilla over here, very interesting cover by Herb Trimpe. Like I say, I like the way Hercules is drawn, but I'm not quite sure about the cover as a whole. Billy, what do you think?
No, I am not either. And like, just listen, hear me out. What if you took the first splash page and took away all the, you know, nonsense and captions and stuff and used that as the cover instead? I think
Ah,
it would work way better than the actual cover.
okay. I agree. I agree. That is a fantastic image you have on the first splash page with Godzilla standing and straddling the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco.
Yeah, it's way better than the cover. I don't know. The cover is just, if it didn't say Godzilla on the front, you wouldn't know what the heck this is. You can't tell it's Godzilla even. It looks not great. And then, like I said, Hercules looks pretty good. Black Widow looks okay. And Iceman and who is that Angel? They're just like, whatever. They look okay too. But it's just, yeah, it's not awesome.
No, I agree. I mean, Iceman looks like he's gonna stab Godzilla in the eye with an ice spike, or with a, you know, which he created. And you know, Hercules is throwing this piece of concrete, or you know, at Godzilla's teeth. Black Widow is looking as if she's more afraid of our Olympian than she is of the kaiju. She's
Well,
like.
we'll get into that with some of this dialogue in here.
Okay.
Don't worry. Maybe she really
Oh,
is.
yeah, man. Hercules is coming hard at old Black Widow in this issue. He's hitting on her pretty
In
badly.
more way than one, he's coming at her hard.
Oh,
So,
it's bad, dude. Yes.
yeah.
Yes,
Holy
you're right.
crap. Yeah. Jeez Louise.
Damn, yeah, man. But yeah, Godzilla, you know, he's in San Francisco Bay. Well, in the Bay Area, right? You call it that, and at the Golden Gate Bridge. And I like the way they describe him, the monster beyond time and reason. And of course, the Tale of Two Saviors, we just got off of discussing you know, All-Star Squadron issue where it was a tale of three citadels. So they like their Dickens, right, Billy?
Oh yeah, we know, like you and I've talked about before, like all those Bronze Age guys, they were really into, you know, literature and putting quotes in there, and you know, that's and I love it. I love it. I have no problem with it at all, and I love how they were very wordy as well. I know that doesn't float with newer generations, but that's okay. I love it.
Yeah, it's fine. I'm probably introduced by Roy Thomas a little bit. I'm not sure where it started. It might have been even earlier than that. I mean, you had folks as far back as the Silver Age, like Mort Weisinger, asking people like Jim Shooter, who was a kid at the time when he was writing for DC. He asked them to sometimes to look at educational content, like what the kids were studying in school. Let's say, for instance, Moby Dick, you know, from Herman Melville. He would ask them
Melville,
to sort of put that into the comics in order to get the kids to you know, have a bit more of an educational, you know, slant, or to put it more of an educational slant on the comic. Now, that of course did not help. So we got stuff from the Legion of Superheroes era, like the Super Moby Dick of space. You know, so but Roy did it better, you know, because he came from a literary background. He was an English teacher before, and I think high school English teacher as well. So he put that in
Yeah.
And in many cases, young readers sort of learned a lot from that, in the sense of they knew that this title was something they had heard before. They probably tracked it down to find out what it was, and they were pleasantly surprised that Roy, you know, it had a deeper thought process to just the surface level, you know, titles that would appeal to a kid. So that's kind of like a compliment almost, right, Billy? Like saying, hey, you guys can get this, you know, or you probably do get it, and well on you if you do, good on you if you do, but if you don't, you know, hunt it down, look it up. So, you know, good title here. And of course, Doug Munch, one of the better writers at Marvel in the 70s. I mean, there were a lot of great writers, but Doug Munch, one of our favorites. Yeah. He's got mean writing chops, but this was still geared towards kids, you know, this comic. So good on Munch, you know, for following the Roy Thomas route here.
Yeah, I think our buddy, oh gosh, what's the guy's name that has the Epic Marvel podcast? Crap, I forgot the dude's name. But anyway, he hasn't put any content out in a while. I don't know. I hope everything's cool there. But when he was doing, you know, podcasts on the regular, he had done a pretty long interview, I think, with Doug Munch, and he kind of asked him a little bit about everything, and they did have some Godzilla conversations. And you know, whether he was told it was, you know, supposed to be toned back for kids, or that was just how he took it. Either way, yeah, he was definitely writing this for, you know, kids. This was definitely not an adult comic or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, which is strange, because the people over in Tokyo and Japan who loved Godzilla, you know, the fans from Asia, they were all across the board. It wasn't just kids, you know, it was everybody. You know, but the Americans interpreted this as, oh, okay, we can spin this as a kid's comic because, hey, giant monster, dinosaur, kids love that. But interesting, right, Billy? So, yeah, we've got, you know, then, of course, S.H.I.E.L.D. still hot on the heels of old, you know, the Big G, because after all, they've been dogging him, but not really managing to be more than annoying mosquitoes for Godzilla. But now the champions are sort of taking a hand. Now, Billy, I want to ask you, before we get into this, the champions, like you say, based in Los Angeles, so the nearest, you know, super team, I guess, to San Francisco. What do you think about the champions as a team? Did you ever read them when you were young? Did you?
I mean, I have, I think it was only about, what, 15 to 18 issues long or something like that, the run, and I have a good bit of them. The ones I read were okay. You know, I liked some of the artwork in them and stuff, but I just felt like, you know, Marvel created that comic from heroes that just didn't have a home or didn't fit in somewhere else, and they just threw them in a comic to, you know, give them something to do, which that's never a great idea. You know, let's take these leftovers and throw them in a book together. Unless you had somebody that came and said, hey, I have this great idea for a team and a clear direction with it. That's probably a really bad idea, but it's not terrible, but they're just not, there's a lot more things from Marvel of the day that I like a lot better.
Exactly. No, the thing is, I'm going to be upfront here and say I never liked the champions. If Ghost Rider wasn't there, you know, then I don't like them. And Ghost Rider is not here. You know, and Ghost Rider didn't show up in every issue either.
No.
But he was supposed to be part of the regular team. But the way, you know, he's kind of like the Hulk, you know, Ghost Rider, sort of. He can't always be everywhere. He can't be part of a team, really. You know, that's just the way it is with his transformation and whatnot. So, but,
And then the stuff that was going on in his own title was way better than this anyway. Oh, yeah. So why read, you know what I mean? Like if Marvel thought, hey, Ghost Rider is selling well, let's throw Ghost Rider in the champions to see if people will buy that. Like people aren't stupid. If they pick up the champions, the Ghost Rider's in it and it's not great, they're going to be like, this sucks, not buy it. Or if Ghost Rider's not in it, they're not going to buy it. So it didn't make any sense to put him in there because he had his own solid book at the time.
Yeah, that's right. That's why it felt incongruous for Ghost Rider to be there. But when he was there, I liked the title, but it made no sense that he should be there. I mean, they're based in a skyscraper, right? Los Angeles. Obviously, it's possible for them to... It's kind of like the Baxter Building for the FF over in New York. But this is possible because, after all, Warren Worthington, you know, the Angel, rich, right? Tony Stark level rich. So, but, you know, then it still doesn't make sense for me. Like someone like the FF with all their machines, with all the science that Reed needs to bring, you know, to the team, that makes sense for them to have a whole building And it's not even the complete building that the FF have, right? To themselves. Yeah. But here it's a skyscraper only for them. It's like, why? Four heroes with a skyscraper for headquarters. And then, Billy, they've got the worst ever. Well, the transportation is not bad, but the name. What is the name of their what do you call it? Their mode of transportation, their flying vehicle.
Oh, dear Lord. The Champ's craft.
Oh. All I'm going to say is by the cloven hooves of Pan. Who came up with that name? Jeez.
Mm-hmm. And again, we love Doug Minch, and he wrote this. So maybe he had something to do with that. I don't know, but I just...
I doubt it.
Lord, that's terrible.
No, but yeah, they aren't a team that I will remember fondly. It's just it's too many different. I mean, they've got two mutants, right? Two old friends.
Mm-hmm.
But you know why don't you separate them? I mean, why have Angel and Iceman together again? They don't need to be together. Do like the Beast. Put him off in the Avengers without any other of his mutant contemporaries. Come on. But these two guys are together again. Then you have Black Widow and Hercules. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a team of four, this is really weird. If it was a larger team, yeah, sure. You know, you can have a lot of variety like the Avengers. I don't know. But I do love, you know, Hercules. I like him as a character. But, you know, they don't treat him very well here. I mean, like you say, he hits on Black Widow something fierce. It's almost, what did you say, Weinstein level, you know.
He's like, I don't think it's funny because they actually write the scene as if she doesn't get it at first.
Yeah,
like, or she's just like so in shock by it or something. I don't know, but I'm thinking, okay, it's Hercules. He's like one of the horniest guys ever. Like, he's almost as bad as what's his name from Titan, the guy that can use his
Star Fox.
They should be best buddies, but it's like, you know, come on. But yeah, she doesn't, they kind of write her as like, she's kind of dense about it at first. And he's really like putting a hint out there like, hey, baby, we're alone right now. And it's like, okay, dude, chill out.
That's right. I mean, Star Fox, like you mentioned, he's like a walking roofie. Really, Billy. Yeah. He's like that. It's horrible. But Hercules too, kind of, you know, he's a god, you know, handsome, muscular, but he's always using this power on the mortal ladies. It's not kosher. But Billy, then I think what makes this issue kind of still a standout, and I still enjoyed it, is the action. Because the action played against S.H.I.E.L.D., you know, the champions in S.H.I.E.L.D. obviously don't get along because Dum Dum Dugan, this is his territory. He doesn't want some long underwear types messing with his project here. And listen... Billy, this is one of the greatest lines in the book, where when Dum Dum's discussing, well, he's giving his staff a dressing down, right? Because he's upset that they haven't been able to do anything against Godzilla. So Dum Dum says, "Have you forgotten how that stinking monster's already made us look like monkeys twice now? And that three strikes is all you get in Papa Dugan's book?" And then he goes off on Gabriel, you know, Gabriel Jones, because Gabriel's feeling, you know, some sympathy for the monster. After all, you know, Godzilla's not malevolent. He's just being attacked. Yeah, he is malevolent in, you know, if you look at it from a different perspective. But, you know, he's just wandering around the countryside, and then these folks keep attacking him. He's not particularly murderous. He hasn't killed anybody so far. He's just destroyed a lot of property. But this is not allowed. So, you know, he assaults the Golden Gate Bridge. Champions are in their little champs craft, which is very similar to the FF's little, you know, vehicle, but with wings attached, though. that yeah, shows me that they don't have Reed Richards' level of tech. And, you know, it's not just the champs craft. You know, it's obviously nowhere near as cool as the Fantastic Car, because the Fantastic Car looks like a little loaf of bread, a flying loaf of bread, which is cool. But this one, Billy, the C logo and the gold and blue color of this Champ's Craft, that just doesn't do it for me. I mean, the C logo looks like some kind of a vise or a clamp or something. I don't know.
It almost looks like the A on Aquaman's chest sometimes, turn it a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good bitter analogy there. And, you know, then they're on the Golden
Gate. Oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
It almost looks like a penis there, if you kind of look at it, really.
The tip. The tip.
It kind of does in that one panel there. Yeah, it's not like sharp edges. It's all rounded and stuff.
Oh, man, it's weird. That's really weird, dude. Now that you said that, now I can't unsee it. Oh, that's horrible. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
If this was a beloved property of mine as a child, the Champions, I would be really offended with you right now, Billy. But hey, I'm not. This is... But you know, the way Trimpy also draws the helicarrier is quite cool. He draws it as mm-hmm. this fat looking little flying, cetacean kind of like craft. You know, everything's like roundish. You know, the helicarrier looks a little chubby, you know, like it's been snacking on clouds or something, cotton candy clouds, I don't know. But Iceman shows mm-hmm. up here at the Golden Gate Bridge. You know, he's the Angel's the more mobile, but it seems that Iceman is, you know, warning the folks down on the ocean level to stay away, the Coast Guard and so forth, because he's saying that, you know, the best they can do against a monster like this is crowd control for now. Mm-hmm. And then because he's in the water, none of them are aquatic, except, well, Iceman could probably surf on the surface there with his eyes, but he doesn't. And then Godzilla wanders away from the Golden Gate Bridge. He wasn't going to destroy it, but then, you know, the police, these idiots, start opening fire. But okay, Godzilla mm-hmm. was kind of treading on the land there, you know, so he was demolishing mm-hmm. some buildings there, but everything's been evacuated. Then swats Angel out of the sky with a swipe of its tail, which is accidental. It says it's accidental. He didn't mean to do that. He was just turning when the cops started firing. And then mm-hmm. we've got a pretty impressive feat of strength by Hercules here, right, Billy? Angel's about to be crushed beneath Godzilla's mm-hmm. heel. And what does Hercules do?
He jumps over there, and as Godzilla's foot is coming down, he kind of like... gets underneath it and like bench presses his foot and just boom, pushes him with all his might and knocks Godzilla over, which is pretty cool because then it flips to like this gigantic splash page of Godzilla just flying, you know, a few feet back and then onto his rear end.
Exactly. Now, dude, this is, I mean, during the era when I still considered Hercules a match for Thor and the Hulk. And in fact, he is. Or he was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason why I say was, I'll get to it just now. It's just that you remember there were many battles against Thor where Hercules sometimes won. Sometimes it was a stalemate. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. Same with the Hulk. It never ended in a clear victory. He could hold his own against the Hulk.
Right.
But Billy, then came the mid-80s when John Byrne got on the Hulk. And there was this, I don't know if you ever read that, but the John Byrne era of the Hulk had Bruce Banner being separated from the Hulk, you know, so they were two separate,
mm-hmm.
two completely physically separate beings, and then the Hulk was rampaging through the countryside. So they sent Wonder Man, Iron Man, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, Namor the Submariner, and Hercules mm-hmm. after the Hulk.
Wow.
And all four of them together in a fair fight in the desert with no civilians nearby to cause, you know, distress or to cause them to not, you know, be on their full game here. All four of them couldn't take him out. So after that, I was like, oh man, I mean, Thor, if Thor was there, yeah, because Thor could go with the Hulk one-on-one still in the 80s easily. But John Byrne, for me, then established that the Hulk is just, I mean, Hercules with four of his compatriots of the Avengers couldn't even take out the Hulk. You know, so is Hercules really that strong? But here he's depicted as still Hulk level, because he sort of almost hurls Godzilla into the sky here. You know, just he topples him, but the way it looks is that he pushes him up into the air a bit there.
Yeah, he almost picked him up and threw him a little bit.
Exactly. And then Godzilla just goes crazy and unleashes his atomic breath, which makes Hercules rethink his options here. But Dum Dum's now aware of the Champions. He's really upset.
Mm.
And now it's going
to
be...
Oh, yeah, he's pissed.
It's not going to be Godzilla versus the Champions. It's more going to be S.H.I.E.L.D. versus the Champions. Not really, but, you know, they're going to get in each other's way. That's going to cause some funny bits, right,
and
Billy?
And then Mench... Yeah, I love Mench's dialogue, yeah. He has Hercules looking at Dum Dum Dugan. We arrive first. 'Tis our right to battle yon dragon beast. And Dum Dum says... It's also your right to get a bust of the snoot, pal. If you don't, any Hercules, dost thou know to whom thou speakest, mortal? I am Hercules. And Dugan says, I don't care if you're Atlas, jerk. As far as I'm concerned, you're a civilian, and that makes you a vigilante. And that makes you a lawbreaker. Now, why don't you just pick up your globe and shove off?
That's a great line, because, in fact, during one of his labors, Hercules did have to support the heavens, right? You know, that yeah. classic statue of Atlas picking up the globe. He's equating him with Atlas. Oh, it's great. Yeah, Dum Dum's the character. Mm-hmm. He's my favorite character in these Godzilla comics. I've always loved Dum Dum. Mm-hmm. Ever since that, what was it, the Marvel premiere issue with Dominic Fortune and Howard Chaykin. You know, that's when I've loved Dum Dum. But, you know, part of the Howling Command is always great. This, in Godzilla, though, Doug Munch's dialogue really makes him shine. But then, Billy, he does. Godzilla does, in fact, then destroy the Golden Gate Bridge. Hercules manages to stabilize it, you know, prevents it from completely plunging into the drink here. But Iceman, his powers are also not having great effect. He freezes Godzilla's head. Godzilla just, you know, opens his jaw a couple of times and, you know, smashes the ice off of his head. And then Hercules makes a swim for it just as S.H.I.E.L.D. is dropping these electric nets. And because of that, Dugan, when he spies Hercules swimming towards Godzilla, he says, no, hold it. Don't drop the nets. But it's too late. And then he throws off their aim, the S.H.I.E.L.D. troopers who are all wielding these little, they're sporting these rocket packs, right, that they're jetting around on. The Dum Dum as well.
Johnny Quest style.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And then, you know, the electric nets miss Godzilla and Hercules is buffeted by the currents. But this is another feat of impressive strength from Hercules here, Billy. He swims to the bottom of the ocean, right? What does he do?
Mm-hmm. He grabs a piece of the Golden Gate Bridge, like a piece of highway, and comes to the surface and throws it at Godzilla's head.
Yeah, Godzilla ducks. Right? Mm-hmm. It's implied that he ducked that projectile. And now this is Hercules showing his incredible strength here, Billy, because think about it, a giant piece of the Golden Gate Bridge hurled by this tiny figure at Godzilla's head, and it's bigger than Godzilla's head. Then what does it do when it misses Godzilla?
Misses Godzilla. Yeah, then it smashes into the helicarrier and it goes down. And then we get another beautiful, huge splash page of Godzilla, like, looming over the fallen helicarrier, like, ha, ha, ha. And then he just walks away, and Dugan flips his lid.
Yeah, exactly. Not before playfully crushing one of the tail fins of the helicarrier. Oh, man.
Yeah, in his hand.
Oh, it's great. And then, you know, he just walks away, and Dugan vows revenge again. But they sort of make up with the champions there at the end, right? Where they say, yeah, we all should have worked together. We should have, you know, seized this opportunity to cooperate rather than fight amongst each other. And then we've got next issue, Godzilla versus Bat-Dragon. Bat-Dragon. I always wanted to say Bat-Dragon, which is actually the better name, but it's Bat-Dragon. There's no D in there. But we'll get to that. That's a pretty good issue's coming up, Billy.
Yeah, they're going to... Marvel, and I don't know whose decision it was, but they're going to eventually bring in some monsters to fight Godzilla, because, I mean, obviously after a few issues here, we know S.H.I.E.L.D. isn't cutting it, and what are we going to do, have 20 issues of S.H.I.E.L.D. getting beat up, and even, you know, some of these little Marvel heroes aren't really able to do anything, so they're going to go, like, full-on, you know, monster movie here and have other big giant kaiju fight Godzilla, which is cool, but it sucks that they weren't allowed to use any of the other monsters. But they create some fun ones, you know, and some
on their own. Yeah,
I'm gonna say, parodies, but a mirror universe kind of type.
Yeah, they're almost parodies.
Yeah,
but that's gonna be there's good times ahead, really. I mean, that's why we're gonna keep doing Godzilla for a little while, you know, until you know, we want to jump to another property, but. Some fun times. I mean, I just want to get to that issue where it's Dum Dum versus Godzilla when they're the same size. That's going to be... Oh, just trust me, listeners, that's a fantastic issue. So, Billy, now let's head off to the last in line here, but not the least, definitely by no means, which is, of course, the Micronauts. And we're going to talk about this issue. I'm quickly going to run through the details here. And then you're going to give us the... Oh, wait. You know what we didn't do? Right, Billy, is we didn't do our synopsis for Godzilla. Sorry about that. Well, let's do it now because I mean we talked about the issue already, but why not? We might have some nuggets of gold in there. So what's your Godzilla synopsis?
Yeah, we talked more about it just as we would a regular issue, so there's an extra treat for you listeners. But mine says mysteries abound in this issue, such as will Black Widow fall for Hercules' attempts to bed her? Will Dum Dum Dugan give everyone on board the helicarrier cancer? Will Tony will Tony Stark be able to stay sober long enough to help stop Godzilla? Listen in to find out.
Oh, dude, I'm oh, that's a great synopsis. Okay, mine doesn't come close to you. I just had the Tony Stark alcoholic bit in there. I didn't have the dum-dum with his chain smoking.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that, but Tony made a tiny little cameo.
That's true. Yeah, I mean the Japanese experts that were drafted to come and help the Americans, that little team, Tony showed them around, you know, Stark Industries and showing them, you know, a bit of his tech. And then one of them seems to be, you know, they've got a bit of a spy in their ranks. We don't know, but we'll find more, find out more about that later on. I've got a little bit of that in my synopsis. So, Billy, I wrote down the following. Frisco suffers kaiju wrath as Godzilla totals the Golden Gate Bridge. Dum Dum and Gabriel are hot on its heels, but then end up babysitting the champions. Two teams clash as the Big G sits on the sidelines watching the puny humans go at it. Oh, and Tony Stark gives the kaiju experts a tour of his digs and probably his liquor cabinet. One of his guests has sinister intentions. Yeah, there we go. I should have put something in there about Hercules hitting on Natasha. Damn.
It's out of hand. Yeah.
Now, Billy, in order to not miss our synopsis again, we're going to launch straight into the Micronauts issue. But first, let me just run through these details here. Of course, Micronauts cover dated. This is Micronauts number 3. Cover dated March 1979, but on sale December the 5th, 1978. Cover price 35 cents. 32-page count, and edited by Al Milgram. The cover was penciled by Michael Golden and inked by Joseph Rubinstein. The title of this story is Death Duel at Daytona Beach, similar to what we saw in the, you know, the teaser on the of issue 2 at the end. And then it's written, of course, by Bill Mantlo, penciled by Michael Golden, inked by Joseph Rubinstein, lettered by John Constanza, and colored by Carl Gafford, which we know, of course, from our All-Star Squadron podcast, right? World on Fire. See a lot of Carl Gafford in there. And yeah, you'll have to pick this up in its original form, or there was a special edition printed in 1983 where you can also find this issue in. And even, I think it was also reprinted in Marvel's Special Edition, Micronauts Special Edition, number 1 and number 2. So, Billy, nice cover. Michael Golden again, just still a little bit too busy for me. What do you think about this cover?
Yeah, there is a lot going on there. I think it would be a lot more effective if it was a little more stripped down, for sure. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the best thing about the cover is the Baron Karza, you know, corner box for me. But if it's stripped down, like you say, it would have been better. It's just, I don't know, this just, it looks like a couple of little drones flying around, just you know, making life for the people of at Daytona Beach hell. But it doesn't have anything, I mean, there's too many effects, you know, explosions happening everywhere, too much detail. Golden's known for his insane amount of detail, but don't put too much detail on a cover unless you've got a central image to focus it. You know, to focus the reader's attention on. Here, there's no center image, right, Billy? In fact, the center image looks like it could be a sidewalk or something. I don't know. So, yeah, I agree with you. It's not one of my favorite covers. But it's got Michael Golden's weird anatomy, which I loved, you know, on stuff like Kazar and you know, when he did Elric and Doctor Strange. You know, I love the way he draws anatomy. It's just weird. It's cool. And faces and eyes. And so, you know, you've got that part of it. And he's not bad at drawing, you know, sci-fi tech. In fact, that's one of the reasons. That's one of the reasons he took the gig to draw Micronauts, because he was getting tired of superheroes over at DC. You know, he had been doing some DC work, mostly on the Superman family titles. And Batman too, right, Billy? A little bit of the, I think, Batman family titles, and then just a fill-in artist. But yeah, he wanted to draw something sci-fi or something fantasy particularly. He didn't want to draw superheroes. He was kind of like a John Buscema. But John Buscema was stuck drawing superheroes his entire career. His mid to late to retirement. But I think Michael Golden kind of got away with not drawing superheroes and still making a success. So, Billy, now your synopsis. Let's have it.
Mm-hmm. So after causing havoc in a rural backyard, our heroes are heading towards Daytona Beach. But Prince Shaitan is hot on their heels and means to destroy them. But the police and Air Force get involved, but they can't understand what's going on or what they are dealing with. Yeah. All right, so what do you got, buddy?
Great, man. I've got... okay, let me get to it. Okay. A Daytona Beach skateboard park becomes a war zone as Prince Shaitan and his Spartak Shock troops get their butts royally kicked by their deposed king. Marie and Arcturus fantasize about each other while Bug is slumming it in Ray Coffin's smoldering backyard. Baron Karza chats up old crone Belladonna as he prepares to put Prince Argon under the knife. Meanwhile, Ray Coffin discovers some mini alien corpses. Cue the X-Files theme. So oh, yeah, that crazy.
I like the first page, man. That splash page is cool. The guy coming out and flipping out on the kid because the backyard's like demolished. Oh. I like how it starts out with a little bit of humor there.
Yeah, well, I mean, the kid's hide is saved once the dad finds those little dead aliens and that little, I mean, basically the corpses of those Spartak troops that suffered during the first encounter with the Micronauts. And he finds them, and he's associated with the military, right? He works for over at Cape Canaveral or something, and he's in the science division, so he's going to investigate. And, I mean, he's also aware of the military protocol to report, alien encounters. So we'll see Ray Coffin showing up quite a bit, right, Billy? In fact, he's going to be associated with the character of Captain Universe, which is something that the Micronauts is known for. But we'll just tease that for now and speak about that later. some mad space action in this, because, I mean, this is kind of like a Star Wars chase, let's say TIE fighters chasing down the Millennium Falcon. But if it was miniature and it happened in Daytona Beach, this is what that would be like. It's the Millennium Falcon dodging not asteroids or giant space monsters, but dodging skateboarders and fleeing from these miniaturized accroyers who are pursuing them. So some interesting bits, right, Billy?
Yeah, one thing to remember too is, or if you don't know, if you haven't read it yet, they're in these miniature sizes, but their weapons are still powerful enough that, like, they shot somebody, they killed them, and they damaged property and smashed stuff. So it's not like, it's like a BB gun. Like, their weapons are still powerful enough to, like, destroy property and smash cars and stuff, and it's great.
That's right. And we learned that, Commander Rand's spaceship that he used to pilot with Biotron through the multiverse is not actually a warcraft. It's got weaponry. Mm-mm. It's got enough to defend itself, but it's actually no match for these fighters. It's also probably a technology thing, right, Billy? Because if you think about it, the Endeavor, it's 1,000 years old. I mean, compared to the tech that the Spartak troops that work for Baron Karza under the control of Prince Shaitan, who deposed a courier, their tech is much more advanced. So that's another worry for the Micronauts. And then a courier, saves the day. Now this shows how truly powerful a character he is, right, Billy? Not only does he wield the power sword, which he has, that little energy blade of his, which is capable of slashing these miniature space fighters apart, he can also, he's incredibly physically strong. He can stop a spaceship flying at hundreds of miles an hour in midair with a kick. And this spaceship is... what, 20, 30 times his size, even more. Yeah. But he can stop it with a kick. So he's one of the strongest characters in the Marvel Universe. But, obviously his size is what hampers him. But he's incredibly powerful. I mean, in later issues, we'll see him pick up weights similar to that of a spacecraft and hurling it, you know, great distances. So immeasurably strong, this little Micronaut, a Croyer. Always one of my favorite characters. I mean, my friends all call him Acroyer. You know, when they, you, I don't know how you pronounce it, but I'm going to go with a Croyer.
That sounds much better.
And there's this great bit where I think the park office, you know, where the skateboard rink is located, it gets blasted. And then this guy's on the phone and he says, "You heard me." He's on the phone with the cops, right? He says, "You heard me. I'm under attack by toy spaceships. No, I ain't drunk. Get me the police." Scratch. His office just explodes. Oh, it's insane. And then, you know, this is an action-packed issue from the beginning to the end, right, Billy? Non-stop space chasing. And then, you know, during this the fight, Marie has to man the gun turret. This is very Star Wars-esque, but this is before Empire Strikes Back. So, I don't know, man. It could be that Micronauts inspired that scene. I'm just saying, Billy, you know the scene where... Or actually, this is in the first Star Wars movie where everybody has to man... Okay, so actually, no. Star Wars inspired this scene, probably. Sorry, I should amend that because probably. 1977, this is 1979. But still, Billy, think about that scene where they all rush to in the Millennium Falcon to man the gun turrets. And this happens in here, the Endeavor. Marie, Marionette, Princess Marie, she mans a gun turret, plus a little Microtron. Her butler, her little servo bot.
Servant,
Who's great. He mans it upside down. And his dialogue's even written upside down. So.
I was just going to say the dialogue's upside down too.
Oh, man. And then while Marie's showing her skills here at sniping these spacecraft, Commander Ren, who's also now flying outside because he's got his glider pack on. He's known as Space Glider. You know, he's pretty good at that. He thinks to himself, "She's one hell of a girl." So he wanted to say woman, but then he has to remind himself he's 1,000 years older than she is.
Right.
Which is silly. I mean, come on, dude. You didn't age. You were in cryo sleep all this time. Now, Billy, right in the middle of this action, they decide to insert this fantastic bonus poster.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's so good. A Baron Karza. Yep.
Fantastic, dude. This is amazing. This is him in his regular armor and then in his centaur body. Courtesy of the body banks, when he's at, you know, going to war, he can become the centaur.
And it says there's a little thing about him there, too. Yeah, a little blurb and everything. Looks great.
Oh, yes. Fantastic. And so, well done, Golden and Rubenstein. And then, you know, Billy, we've got the army getting in on the action. You know, you've got these at 3,500 feet. They mentioned these Air Force planes are being scrambled to deal with this UFO threat. And the police are there. Yeah. You know, they're showing up in force. You've got Prince Shaitan showing off some transformer abilities of his spacecraft there to split into a couple of different sections and basically become different craft. That's what his spacecraft is known for. But then Acroyer just football kicks it, right? Soccer kicks it, and then damages it significantly for them to chicken out, you know? And he says, I mean, he even says right when Acroyer stops them in midair, Prince Shaitan panics and shouts. He says, "Warp, you fool, before he does worse than that." Okay, this is something that not even Shaitan knew his brother was capable of. This incredible feat of strength. And it is presented, I mean, Acroyer is presented as a type of mutant, you know, in his people. He's a sort of like a Prince Namor submariner. He's not a half-breed, you know, Billy, but he's the strongest of his kind. Way stronger than the rest. He's almost like Thor for the Asgardians, you know, Thor being like...
Right.
A regular Asgardian could lift 40 tons. Thor can lift like 40,000 tons, something like that, you know. that's, you know, so his feats of strength even amaze his own people. There's no limits, seemingly, to his muscles, to what his muscles can do. And then, you know, brief reprieve, the Micronauts are safe. And again, you know, they're now dealing with the fact that Baron Karza knows that the space wall can be breached and that there are other worlds to conquer. So they're worried about that. So eventually they're going to have to bring the fight back to Karza before he, you know, manages to come to Earth. And then we have this final panel of Bug still missing, but he's hanging out in the backyard of Stephen Coffin and his dad, Ray Coffin. And he's spying on the dad, making a call to his superiors, saying that, you know, there was an alien encounter between his son and some kind of life form. And he's got the proof right here in a little box.
Yeah, it looks neat. That's a really good scene right there. And then that final splash page with the cop.
Oh, that's a great page. That park, you know, manager or whatever he is. Yeah, Martinelli, right? He's being, you know, interrogated by this cop. But Martinelli's clearly been through hell, man. He's got a broken arm, bandages all over himself. And then the cop still says, "You sure this ain't an insurance scam, Martinelli?"
He goes, "I see aliens this big, and all you cops can say is, I'm nuts."
And then next issue, a body hunt on Homeworld while the Micronauts roam the Earth. A hunting we will go. So, Billy, quick aside, there's a character that's being introduced that will show up again and again, one of Baron Karza's, you know, allies, and that is the Lady Belladonna. You know, she is this old crone in this issue. She comes towards Baron Karza saying that, you know, she wants what was promised to her, a new body. She's aging, she's dying, and she first wants the body of Princess Marie, which was promised to her, right? Princess Marionette. But since she escaped...
Yeah.
Baron Karza says, "I only managed to capture her brother, Argon." She says, "Well, then I'll take his body." And then he says,
"Oh, no.
Oh, no, no, no. Sorry, he's also not available. I've got plans for him." So that refers to the surgery that he's got planned for poor Prince Argon, Marie's brother. But Belladonna, she's an evil character. She's gonna have quite some panel time in future issues. But Billy, what did you think about this issue as a whole?
Yeah, it was fun. A lot of action. And then just as an aside, Golden and Rubenstein, they draw a super sexy marionette. Oh, like, wow, she looks really good.
She's stunning.
Holy
moly. She is stunning. One of my favorite Marvel ladies. You know, if I like put my favorites up there, She-Hulk, Spider-Woman, Valkyrie, you know, Patsy, Hellcat. But Hellcat's a little bit weird for me to like. You know, when I was a kid, I was in love with her. But now, you know, when I read her, she's still very young. You know, it's weird. It's kind of like, you know, that Dave Stewart's drawing Dolphin in the Who's Who issues. I'm like, oh, when I was a kid, I was crazy about Dolphin, but now I don't know if I can look at that the same way. You know, it's a little bit strange. But you know, let's say, for instance, those gals, I'll put Marionette right up there with those ladies. So, Billy, unfortunately, the three covers, though, I can't pick a favorite because I don't like any of them. I'll probably go, just by default, I'll go for Rom as my favorite cover because of that dire wraith just getting mutilated by Rom on the cover there. But none of the covers really did it for me. What about you?
Yeah, same here. I would go Rom as well, but not because it was awesome, just because it was less goofy than the other two.
Exactly. But favorite issue... three great issues, three good issues. I'm this time around, I was going to give it to Rom, but this time I'm going to give it to the Micronauts. I don't know why, Billy, the Micronauts, it's just the breakneck pace of this space chase or this Daytona Beach chase. And it felt Star Wars-esque, but in a totally different setting with these giants looming around them, which is just regular folks, and their reaction to this space battle, replaying in their backyards, literally.
Yeah.
And then also the skateboarders and the skate park and Daytona Beach being torn up by these toy, what they think of as toy drones. Oh man, I loved it. And then you've got some great, you know, mythology also playing a role, future mythology that Bill Mantlo's going to introduce, like, you know, Lady Belladonna and the body banks. And you've also got, you know, Baron Karza's plans for a greater invasion. And then, of course, A Courier's heroic feats. A Courier's my favorite Micronaut. I don't know. I probably mentioned that before. And he's definitely the hero of this tale. The most valuable player. The MVP. Yeah. But fantastic character moments, too, between Arcturus and his, you know, lust for Marionette, but him also thinking, this is wrong. This is just wrong. She's too young. And from Marionette's side, too, she's feeling it, right? She's got Commander Rann in her sights. So I'm going to give it to Micronauts. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I would still go with ROM, but it's a lot closer this time around than it was the other time. You know, I definitely think Micronauts really bridged a huge gap with this issue between where it was last issue and the first two, honestly, compared to ROM.
Yeah, dude, ROM is still fantastic. I love it. But, you know, this is where the Micronauts became more focused, because, in fact, what happened is after Micronauts number one, the creative team got a bit of a, you know, a scolding from editorial saying, this first issue was all over the place. We didn't know what was going on. Nobody understood it. The art was amazing, but what are you guys trying to do here? It's directionless, you know, and then come issue two and then issue three, especially they started to focus it more. And they didn't go quite as wide, you know, with such a large cast of characters as they did during the very first issue. So it became more focused on, you know, character development rather than universe building. But the universe building is still going to be there. It's just going to happen at a slower pace. Yeah, which is better for the reader, I think.
Yeah.
So, Billy, great three issues. ROM's your favorite cover. We're going to give it to ROM as well. But Micronauts was the winner for me over here. We're coming back, though, next month, in the month of September, with some more great issues. Issue four of all of these titles, and I'm sure our listeners would love it. But we'll take this opportunity to, again, thank our patrons. We've got a new patron on board, Gary Arkell, and he joins Brian and Dan and Ryan, and you know, thanks Gary for signing up. I also thank Gary on the main show, which dropped just a few days ago. So thanks, and if it wasn't for you guys, we wouldn't be enjoying this so much, and I'm having a blast. What about you, Billy?
Oh yeah, absolutely, it's a lot of fun to look forward to, and like you said, you know, we're gonna, some of these properties we're talking about now, we're gonna see them through for quite a while, you know, our favorites, and then others we're gonna, you know, maybe drop off and go with something else. And then like you said, we're gonna get some polls up real soon for you know, our patrons that are already signed up, and you know, give them some flexibility with what they might want to hear on the episodes. And then, you know, we've been kicking it around, and we're probably gonna activate it soon, is you know, throw it out there that anybody that even just wants to throw us a dollar to say, hey, thanks for doing the show, that they can maybe even vote on some things, on some polls to do with the regular feed as well. You know, our in-between issues, not our Doctor Strange issues. We're still going to be doing the doc every other issue, but then the ones in between, maybe we'll throw out some options there too.
Definitely, definitely. So whatever you guys want us to cover, Marvel Bronze Age will be up for. All right. So Billy, thanks, man. This was another great, discussion with you. I had fun reading these comics, rereading them. And it's bringing back my childhood and reinvigorating my love for the medium once again. So with that, we're out of here. I'll say goodbye first. See you soon, listeners. Take care.
All right. See you, everybody.